On the whole, men were better informed than women. 16% of the men were informed, 12% of the women. Here there's hope. The women are doing something about it. The men are not doing anything about it. On your income group, you'll note that better than average, average, and less than average, there is a shrinkage. But note the difference in education. 20% of your college graduates were informed. 17% of your high school graduates were informed. 10% of those who did not enter high school are informed. Here you can do something about it through education. Rural, urban, and regional. Or to look at it the other way. The uninformed among your college group is 3%. Your uninformed among your grade school group is 23%. Now, I'm not talking about grade school or college students. I'm talking about adults who ended their schooling before high school or in college. Now, it must be admitted that the average man in other countries is no better prepared with knowledge than are we. By and large, the average man in Europe is less prepared. But for two reasons, he need not be so well prepared as we need to be prepared. First, the issue for his state, in many cases, is resolved by a totalitarian government, governed by an elite that is informed. Or, second, in other countries, the decisions are less vital because his state currently does not occupy the position of importance our state occupies. Not only had the United States, have Americans elevated foreign affairs to a position of major concern, but they have changed their attitude with respect to the way in which foreign affairs are to be handled. The conduct of foreign affairs is no longer the exclusive business of a few talented gentlemen sitting in the cloisters of the Department of State in Foggy Bottom. It's no longer the exclusive business of a few specialists making plans and negotiating outside the realm of experience and immediate interest of the public. Since many of the more important foreign policies necessitate appropriations, the immediate interest on the part of the public results. No one will quarrel today with the direct declaration that public opinion is the ultimate power which determines foreign policy. Equally obvious is the principle that the kind of public opinion essential to the successful functioning of a government must be an informed and enlightened public opinion. Nor can one dispute the fact that we have not reached the point where we can say that the American citizenry is adequately informed, is unprejudiced, and is steadfast in his views, all of which would help in the formulating of policy. Nor is the American willing to accept the Burkean theory of representation and to tell his congressman or his senator, "You are my representative, act as you think you should act." A national poll in 1946 showed that only 20% of the American public thought that congressmen should vote their own judgment. 80% thought congressmen should vote the judgment of their constituents. The 80% that thought congressmen were public servants and should obey the crack of the whip of the master, the public. On the other hand, 50% of the people asked the question did think that congressmen voted their own judgment rather than the judgment of their constituents. Now, seldom is the individual, as a voter, presented with a clear-cut foreign policy issue on which he may register a choice. Even in the most famous example, the election of 1920, it took weeks and months to interpret the election to mean that there had been a mandate against the League of Nations. More frequently, elected officials are required to interpret the election results and to read meaning into them. On the other hand, the individual does write letters, and he does send telegrams, and he does use the telephone. It would be a mistake to say that the congressman did not learn what his constituency is thinking. He does. He learns it in the flood of mail. For example, in 1935, when the Permanent Court of International Justice was before the Senate for a vote, the President having recommended, as had all his predecessors since Wilson, including Wilson, it looked like it, the vote was a sure thing for ratification in the Senate. The evening before the vote was scheduled, William Randolph Hearst sat in the Mayflower Hotel along with a group of advisors, a few key telephone calls, the same evening, nationwide broadcast by Will Rogers and Father Coughlin against the court, resulted in Congress, in the Senate, receiving the next morning, before the Senate convened at noon, 50,000 telegrams against the court. The individual speaks. He speaks in communications of that sort. One of the most interesting collection of papers are the miscellaneous papers of the Department of State, which incidentally no one has thoroughly mined yet. These are letters to the secretary. They exist literally by the hundreds of thousands. And today, they constitute an important source by which the Department of State undertakes to gauge foreign policy or the public opinion with respect to foreign policy. The analyses now being made of the mail of the Secretary of State and of the President are important in the formulation of policy. And then the individual speaks through his groups. He speaks through what the social scientist likes now to call elites, of which he is members. Thus you have all kinds of groups, sometimes called pressure groups, sometimes other bad names. But these groups have an effect upon foreign policy. To mention a few, the CIO, the AFL, or the Chamber of Commerce and the National Manufacturers Association, the Farm Organization, the Women's Organization, the Veterans Groups. And then you've got a certain constituency of the Department of State itself, a group of individuals, private citizens, who are very vitally interested in foreign policy per se, such as the Foreign Policy Association, the Council of World Affairs of Cleveland, Council of Foreign Relations of New York, and so on. Through these groups, the individual does speak. Speaks to his congressman, to the Secretary of State, to the President. And in doing so, formulates foreign policy. And then, finally, the individual is given an opportunity in the National Commission for UNESCO to actually help formulate foreign policy. Again, speaking through the elites that I mentioned. And when Emerson said that the man in the street does not know a star in the sky, he uttered a profound truth. It is comforting, however, to realize that our ignorance of the firmament can in no way affect the movements of the heavenly body. Unfortunately, the same reassuring thought cannot be used to excuse our ignorance in public affairs. F.C. Morehouse once wrote, "The problem of democracy is not the problem of getting rid of kings. It's the problem of calling the whole people with the elements of kingship." Many Americans, through sheer indifference or incapacity, have abdicated their kingship. We have set up a representative government, and then too often have failed to indicate in what way we wish to be represented. One of the most encouraging aspects of American public opinion is that in the last quarter century or so, we have developed much greater maturity in our approach to international problems. But the increasing complexity of world affairs makes it imperative that we rise more effectively to our responsibility. We should exercise extreme care in the election of our public servants. And in particular, we should give thought to their capacity for a broad approach to foreign relations. To quote Tom Bailey, "It is much better to vote for the right senator than later write to the wrong senator." We should delegate more responsibility to our public officials after we have gone to the pains of selecting the more able. In a sense, we have neither a representative or a delegate government. Not representative because too many of us are too inarticulate. Not delegate because too many of us delegate authority by default. We should educate for statesmanship at the time we are educating for citizenship. If we pick out our ablest men, train them from the beginning, and delegate more authority to them, we shall get a relatively quick return on our investment. We should, above all else, undertake the Gargantuan task of raising the educational level of our entire population. Elihu Root once remarked that when foreign affairs were handled by despots, the danger was in their sinister purposes, and that when they are handled by the people, the danger lies in their mistaken beliefs. We should rip away the prejudice, the encrusted legends about the past of foreign peoples. And for this purpose, we need more critical textbooks, more critical teachers, more critical commentaries, and a more critical public. We should develop more tolerance and realize that in a complicated international situation, one side has never had a complete monopoly of right or truth, and the other side has never had a complete monopoly of the wrong or the untruth. We should learn in our thinking to put ourselves in the other fellow's sandals and view the common problem as he would see it through the lenses of his racial psychology and his national bias. To this end, we should encourage foreign travel, the widespread exchange of students, yes, and of professors. We train ourselves to keep our heads in time of crisis. The mob is always wrong. Even when it hangs a guilty man, it hangs justice. We should keep vigilant and demand of our government that, insofar as possible, it take us into its confidence. A common complaint of the little fellow, the man on the street, as Bailey called him, is that his views do not count. But if he would pool his voice with that of countless other little fellows, it would count for a great deal. If he does not do this, the purposeful minority will rule because it does. Upon every citizen of our democracy rests the solemn obligation to inform himself so that he can direct our foreign policy, his foreign policy, along intelligent and far-visioned lines. And this is about all we can do in the solution of a problem difficult of solution.